Hello and welcome to the blockchain.com podcast. I'm Peter Smith, the CEO and co-founder of blockchain.com. Today I'm here with Yevgeny Gavoy, the CEO and founder of Wintermute Trading. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so first of all, why don't you tell us sort of the three or four sentence summary of Wintermute Trading?
Yeah, sounds good. So, well, basically in a nutshell, Wintermute Trading is one of the leading market makers in the cryptocurrency space. We're active across all major centralized and decentralized platforms. We are very active on the OTC side of things, and we trade about $4 to $5 billion dollars on a daily basis across 200 different crypto assets.
If you were an exchange, where would you guys rank in the leaderboard?
Good question. I think it would be easy top 10.
Yeah, so it's a huge amount of volume on a daily basis. And you guys are relatively new in the crypto space. So you started trading in...
We started in 2017. So it was middle of 2017. I would say first 2 years, we were not super busy expanding because it was much more focused on, well, building the tech and looking at all those massive arcs that people were exploiting back in the days. But when we really started growing was in 2019, when we raised the first proper seed rounds, and especially last year when the whole space grew and we actually outgrew the pace quite a bit ourselves.
And it's probably a good time for the inevitable disclosure moment. We met in 2019 when Wintermute Trading raised their seed round, which our venture fund was the lead investor for. So we are a really delighted investor in Wintermute Trading and have since gone on to raise a lot of other capital from other funds. But you know, it's been a pretty incredible ride to watch from a distance since 2019. Like I think the business is probably growing some almost unfathomable multiple year over year.
Yeah, and I would say it was definitely, getting invested from investment from you guys had been a pivotal moment for us because it was not just about the money. It was, about getting you guys on our board investors, about getting basically into borrowing lender relationship with blockchain.com. So it's definitely boosted up our chances and it allowed us to grow properly in 2020.
Yeah, because the equity investment was important for getting the sort of base layer of capital there, but it was really probably the debt financing that allowed you guys to scale trading volumes in the early days. Like the debt was probably more valuable to the business growth than the equity was my sense at the time.
Yeah, exactly. Because the way most market makers operate, early on, they have a choice between going with sort of like hedge fund model where you basically get the capital from outside investors and you share profits effectively on 80-20 basis or 50-50 basis, like it's sometimes done in crypto. Or you approach lending markets that are basically borrowing directly from big lenders. And it's usually open to you, either if you have a good relationship or you demonstrate a strong track record. And so for us, it was a really important moment to basically move from this share split capital to borrowing from you guys.
And I think part of what you need to move from the profit share structure to the lending structure is a larger equity cushion. You need some kind of recourse capital for folks to lend against. And so, it's probably the most successful equity and debt mixture that we've ever done for a company, but we've done that a lot for companies in the crypto space where we've invested equity capital and then added corresponding debt to help them scale their business, whether it's, a trading company like Wintermute, or a crypto mining company or brokers or all kinds of different stuff. It's a really compelling model in crypto that's kind of almost unique to crypto. If you think about market makers outside of the crypto space, it's hard to think of one that was financed through a mixture of debt and equity at the early days.
Yeah, now that you mentioned that, makes sense. Kind of brings parallels to, 1980s with all kinds of crazy investment, private equity deals that happened there.
Yeah. So let's rewind a little bit. How did you get started in trading? How did you first come into the quant trading space?
Yeah, it wasn't much of a choice because, well, for me personally, because I really loved well, everything related to Mars. I loved finance as well. So like at my last, well, at my last year at Masters, I was doing a finance degree, but I also read a lot of books about, well, different training firms, like books like Larry Sporker, reading like books about investment banking, like Barbara Sutegate, and I just fell in love with finance, with everything finance. And but then when I started searching for, well, for places to work, and I was lucky enough to be in Netherlands at the time, to study in Netherlands at the time. And luckily enough, like a lot of market makers in traditional finance actually based in Amsterdam. And so once I stumbled upon like job offers from IMC or Optiver, it was pretty apparent that I really wanted to work there because they just looked like those really nice flat structures, and but would allow you to, well, focus on trading, do arbitrage, do all kinds of things, and just learn from people in a very informal environment. And that really appealed to me.
What made you like decide to step away from Optiver and start your own business? Like a lot of what happens to people in finance is the money is really good and they get kind of stuck into it, and it's hard to step away from that and go be an entrepreneur. What was like the moment where you're like, okay, I'm done and I want to go build my own company?
Yeah, I was actually kind of setting myself for it since the onset, because like the premise in most of those finance fiction books, like Larry Sporker, like at the end of the story, the hero gets disillusioned with the world of banks he's operating, and he just quits because he has, I don't know, money doesn't mean anything. And I was always wondering like what it would feel like if you make, I don't know, enough money that it just doesn't feel good anymore, because that's sort of like, okay, challenge accepted, I'll just go away from the firm and I will never retire. But what happened with Optiver is like, when I joined, it was a great company. When I left, it was even greater company, like performance wise, but it was also a different company to the company I started at, because it was not like corporate, like a bank corporate, but it was, as they scaled, as they grew, they had to become, well, more focused on, well, execution, on like basically excellence. And this is setting up all kinds of control functions to make sure that the business doesn't blow up. And all this meant that it was much safer environment to be at. So like I could have easily stayed probably at Optiver for another 5-10 years, especially if I moved to one of the control functions, for instance. But it was not necessarily as fun to expand into new markets and like new opportunities, because the approval process for that would take rather long time. So I knew that, I don't know, if I stayed at Optiver and I would start pushing crypto, start trading crypto, it would take me quite some time to convince to even consider this. And at the same time, I was looking at all like colleagues at Optiver who left for various reasons over the years. And I've seen that the guys were doing nothing after their respective careers. So they would just start like a small mini Optiver on the side, doing pretty much exactly the same, but basically just focusing on their, like doing the same, but smaller. And neither of that kind of appealed to me. I thought it would be much more fun to do something new. And this new, it wasn't necessarily crypto, it was, I just wanted something new. And like money did not really motivate me anymore. Like I understood what I was really enjoying at Optiver was building stuff, hiring people for the right roles, and managing those teams to achieve results. And so, well, building my own company, and I didn't know yet it would be focused on trading, but when I quit in the beginning of 2017, I knew it would be something that I wanted to be, that I would be building myself.
So if you knew you wanted to build a company and you wanted to be sort of back hands-on building, hiring, how did the idea for Wintermute originate?
So I went through a big process of like trying to come up with new business ideas. And initially, actually, I really didn't want to do trading, because I thought, like, I went through the stage where trading did not bring any value to society, and like, should I build spaceships or something? But then I also wasn't that much into crypto, to be honest. Like I was reading a lot about blockchain, I was like researching stuff, but I wasn't like I never bought Bitcoin in 2015. I was fascinated by technology, but not necessarily as a financial aspect of it. But once I quit Optima, I had a lot of time on my hands, and I started looking at crypto, and I actually bought some crypto on Coinbase on my credit card. So it was like really awful execution, I guess, from this perspective. But it got my attention pretty quickly, because like literally a week later, it just went up whatever 50 or 100%, because it was just like that moment. And I thought, okay, that sounds actually like fun, because if you look at traditional markets, like they don't move. It's super boring. Like, okay, now you have this GameStop.
So basically you saw the volatility and you were like, yeah, I want a piece of that.
Exactly. Because it just became like, there is so much action. Like the stock goes up and down 10% easily on the day. Yeah. It sounds like fun at the very least. And so I started trading for myself, just doing some manual trades. Tracking was my exchange of choice early on, and I just stick there. And at some point I thought, okay, I do know how to do market making. I do know how to do trading aspect of it. And the market seems to be super inefficient in general. It just makes sense to do something trading related and focus not on making money aspect of it. I mean, obviously I would focus on money making aspect of it, but I would actually do it because I love building stuff. And so I teamed up with another software guy, Hara, who would basically become our first CTO and basically focus on building all the architecture. And at the same time, like the first few weeks, I just spent waiting for him to build things. And then I realized, okay, it's like, I want to monitor our strategies, how they're doing, how they make money, but it will take Haro another months to build some monitoring tools for me, so I can just code myself. But I didn't know how to code, so I just did a few Coursera courses on Python, and I just started coding myself as well, which turned out super cool, because at Optima you don't get to code that much. Like you do get to code a bit in Python to parse the logs, like in regex and everything, but it's not as exciting as doing actual code.
So if that was Wintermute sort of in 2019, so a couple of you guys working on iterating the system, what is Wintermute today? Like, what is the primary products that you guys provide? You know, how many people are you? And, you know, when you sort of look at the firm today, what's the most surprising thing to you? If you were to like go back in time and tell 2019, Evgeny, where you'd be today?
Yeah, I think, starting with where we're now, so it's 45 people at the moment. The core business is making markets on centralized exchanges, I would say.
So tell me what that is, though, for the non-clients right. on the podcast.
So I end up explaining it a lot, actually, because it's a lot of people actually don't know exactly how exchange trading works, because for instance, like I think a lot of people, especially outside of crypto, think that when they go to exchange and they trade in exchange, they trade against the exchange posting orders. But in reality, when you go and buy the offer or sell the bid, you most likely will trade with market makers. And then those will be the parties like us who programmatically show bids and offers on screen in real time, continuously updating them based on different market conditions. And that's exactly what our algorithms are doing. We are posting bids and offers real time on all major exchanges. And that's the core business.
Cool. And outside of that core business, what else are you guys doing?
So, big part of our business is DeFi. And that's very closely connected to what we do on centralized exchanges. It's less volume simply because like, there is less volume going through DeFi at the moment, but it becomes more and more significant for us as a driver of our profits. We've been really early on Uniswap trading. We've been supporting DYDX back from 2019, actually. And we've been basically trying to integrate as fast as possible with all promising DeFi projects. So that's definitely a big angle for us going forward. And we actually believe that it will be bigger than CeFi at some point. OTC business is a big direction for us to expand into. Like, we started it with just helping out a few guys on like a few founders on the projects we were working with to trade in and out of crypto. And it quickly, well, basically we were able to quickly expand this network into more and more people. And it just made sense for us to take it seriously and to make a pro product out of it. So now we have actually our own API that's like big counterparties can connect to and execute against us. Well, basically our major selling point is that we don't focus on, I don't know, top 10 coins. We actually, our coverage is over 200 now and it's growing continuously.
So you guys trade 200 coins?
Yeah.
Wow. And if you go back in time and, you know, tell 2019 when you're getting things about Laramie today, what would be the most surprising thing?
Just how fast we grew. And like my main fear, I guess, back like 2-3 years ago, that like there were already pretty big players in the space. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't see how we could catch up with them so quickly. But like, I guess what I was missing out on was that we are in crypto and everything moves fast. And that's actually, if you are fast enough on execution, you're fast enough on finding opportunities in the space, you can actually catch up with a lot of big guys and become a big player on your own. And so I think for me, the biggest surprise is we got there so fast, just in the scope of 1 year, let's say. Yeah.
So I think that's a good segue. Like, when we made the investment, one of the biggest sort of pushbacks that I received, because it was my investment that I took to the committee, and the biggest piece of pushback that I received was, there's all these big market makers in crypto already, like native crypto market makers that have been around a long time, and then there's all these sort of big market makers from, you know, normal markets that are coming into crypto, you know, Jump, DRW, so on and so forth. How can like a tiny startup compete with those guys when there's people that have already been in the market and these other big guys coming in, right? And in fact, like, the argument was not just that it wasn't possible for a new startup, but that the legacy crypto market makers were going to get completely run over by the sort of like Jumps and Janes and, you know, DRWs of the world. We haven't seen that happen. Like, a lot of the legacy guys have gotten bigger. And then you guys have, you know, become one of the biggest market makers in crypto, you know, in the same time period. Why do you think that the big guys from crossover markets haven't run over the crypto natives?
I think it's kind of the same reason as like a lot of legacy institutions find themselves, well, not able to compete directly with incumbents. It's more like, well, take an example of any big trading company from let's call it legacy finance. They would have a very good structures in place in terms of risk to prevent all kinds of problems, to parse the logs correctly, to rely on exchanges to provide them data in real time. And so a lot of centralized exchanges, and I'm not even talking about DeFi now, most of the centralized exchanges simply won't fit those like risk models. So those companies would face a choice of either scrapping it all completely and rewriting it, or like making some hard choices whether to accept it. And a lot of companies simply cannot accept it because their risk departments are too risk averse. Another problem is the crypto Even 1 year ago, crypto was not big enough for a lot of them. Like, it was, like, for us, it was a lot of volume, but for them, it was the case. There is a lot of volume, but is this volume going to be there in 1 year time? And of course, if they knew that, like, if 1 year ago they knew about where we are now, they would make a different choice. But I think they kept postponing this decision to get there, because a lot of them are just operating on a much longer time frames, because say they're just, okay, if in 5 years time crypto is successful, we'll be there anyway. Like, if you look at what Citadel is saying, that they're just waiting for regulatory approvals, they're waiting for it to become mainstream.
Yeah,
and that's what happens a lot. And also the ones who jump into crypto, they typically focus on Bitcoin, maybe Ethereum, maybe top 5 coins, but they don't focus on 200 tokens, they don't look at the DeFi, because that's already a step too far for that. But that's where we strive. And that being said, like we're still competitive on Bitcoin, we're competitive on centralized exchanges and the most competitive pairs, but we also don't shy away to trade Shiba Inu, for instance. Like last few days, we traded more Shiba Inu than Bitcoin.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. But that would be my advice to any new market makers who start. Just basically focus on your niche, but also make sure that you squeeze as much as possible from this niche to be able to grow fast and expand into a broader space.
So we're talking about the business of learning it today. You're talking about how crucial it is to focus on sort of the niche that you find success in. For Wintermute, you know, you guys have been very focused on spot. Do you guys run risk neutral strategies? Are you taking directional risk? And what's the kind of like drawdowns that you guys experience? Like, I think there's a misconception that a lot of times, you know, market makers are taking this sort of like huge directional risk in the market itself.
Well, I guess define huge. For us, the core business is still delta neutral. So we are market neutral. Some of the tokens that we trade, we do have to take positions in them simply because otherwise we cannot transact spot. A lot of times it's sold by perpetuals because we can go short perpetuals long spot and it gives us enough inventory. And we can, in a lot of perpetuals, we can get paid for that. So that contributes quite nicely to the model. But in general, well, to your earlier points, we do. I think as a small market maker, you cannot really afford to ape into market just massively. But as you grow bigger, you end up looking at some opportunities. If you look at in the dip in back in May, it was for us more of an opportunity because we could afford to take on certain positions on the book. But at the same time, like we would never take a position that would bankrupt us, first of all, and we would also not take a position that would be substantial amount of our balance sheet, because that's not our core business to go on crypto, even though it would have been a really nice trade. But it's our business to trade market neutral. So to answer your question, I would say the golden rule for us is, I would say, like 5 to 10% of our not balance sheet, but more like equity, we can potentially dedicate to like long crypto, but that's like a special opportunity, and it's not a continuous position take.
So there's like a difference for you guys between the strategies which are delta neutral and inventory, which is often has a long skew to it.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense. What do you think, like when you guys are looking at price formation and how to put a price to the market, like how is the price being formed in crypto? Where is price formation occurring? Like how do you guys determine what you should be buying and selling, you know, a Shiba coin for?
It's usually driven by the exchange with the highest volume. That would be the best heuristic most often. But a lot of times it's driven by, well, just where the action happens. Like, I don't know, Shiba Inu, for example, a lot of action has been driven by Coinbase lately. So it would be stupid not to take the Coinbase action into account. With a lot of DeFi coins, you see a lot of action actually happening in DeFi, especially on like AMMs like Uniswap or SushiSwap. And that's, you need your model to be nimble enough to be able to listen to all those signals.
When you guys are trading spot, are you looking at the perpetuals markets? Do you trade the perpetual market? And like, how does the sort of perpetual or leverage markets influence the spot market?
We look at the very least for the trading signals, because the perpetual market is significantly higher for most coins, or for most coins that have perpetuals, that is. And we do trade perpetuals as well from our single coin entity. It does influence us in a lot of ways, because it's not only trading signals, it's also information like funding rates, which we find important because we active borrowers from blockchain.com, for example, and from other lenders. We also see a lot of opportunities on the farming side, and we continuously weigh in whether it makes sense to put our money
on particular, I don't know, short perpetual one spot position, or to dedicate them to farming opportunity, or to or do something else. So it does feed into our decision making a lot.
When you're like monitoring the business, what are you looking at when you come in the morning, and like when you wake up at 2 a.m. at night, what are you looking at? Like, what are you focused on and what are you worried about?
Good question. I think I'm not as worried as I used to be because I think for a long time I woke up and first thing I was checking just the balances that we did not get, nobody hacked us. Now we are quite happy with the current level of security on both CeFi and DeFi. So I'm not that scared of that aspect of the business. So I'm primarily looking at our stocks, like in terms of market share, like where we are on FTX leaderboard, but also what makes money on that particular day or loses money on that particular day, because that's basically all I need in terms of eagle eye view.
What do you worry about in the crypto market at a macro level, though? Like, obviously, Wintermute is tied to the success of the crypto market in a lot of ways. What's like, when you look at the market and the market structure today, what sort of worries you?
I think the regulation would be the main source of worry. And it's multiple levels. Like, the most basic level, if it's all banned across the board, there won't be anything for us to trade, or it will be like so much, so niche, it will be like back to whatever 2016 levels, that is not going to be as exciting to be in. But on a slightly like next level, it also can go direction where a lot of this can go, can become regulated in a way that this won't be like as permissionless as it is now, so that it will go. So it will go back to citadels and virtues of this world to be the only like allowed market makers in crypto, and they will be the only ones to allow to make markets on certain platforms, which will be walled garden from the rest of the world. And from that perspective, one thing that's, on one hand we are worried about, on the other hand we're actively building towards, is to make sure that if this scenario happens, if some version of this scenario happens, we are at least ready for it, and we can participate in it and compete with those guys.
When you think about CeFi versus DeFi, like, what do you think will be bigger 3 or 4 years from now? Like, where will more volume occur, CeFi or DeFi?
I would say, like, philosophically, I would like DeFi to win, and in general, it would also make sense because. Well, like I keep kind of saying that, if DeFi is successful as well, if blockchain is successful as technology, we should see more volume on DeFi than CeFi. That being said, like we see a lot of CeFi platforms like Binance, Coinbase, FTX now as well, becoming more like gateways into crypto. And they do present a pretty comfortable user experience for like all users who don't want to bother with MetaMask and wallets and what's not. So it's a question, I guess, is if DeFi can solve the user experience bit, it should definitely move into DeFi. And like, if you look at DYDX, it actually looks like the user experience is pretty decent. It's more like they need to figure out this last bit, how to get people to, get into DYDX with their credit card, I guess. And then it will be pretty much solved for them. But I would say, user experience is probably the biggest bottleneck for DeFi at the moment, because people think it's nice and fancy and everything, but it's actually horrible for average user. It really is.
So what's bigger in 3 or 4 years?
I wouldn't bet on that. I don't know. I would say as Wintermute, we are getting ready for both. So we're building for both outcomes and maybe whatever extra outcomes that we'll have.
Do you think that the role of market makers will be bigger in a DeFi dominated space or smaller? Like, in some ways you can almost imagine protocols taking over the role that market makers have had, in CeFi markets.
It, like in a really, really long term, I can imagine you could decentralize the role of market makers. In the short to midterm, I don't really believe that it's easy because, well, I know how my business operates. I know how much work it is to create algos that will run across all kinds of platforms. It's not an easy task. You cannot easily decentralize it. And it's also, it's like one of those, like, it's like those people who are selling books, how to become a millionaire. Like, you could say that they are, well, probably not doing good because it's like, why would you sell a book? why would you share this valuable knowledge? It's the same as market maker. You cannot decentralize it because it's a lot about secret sauce, and every major market maker has their own like structure built around it. But it's also about people, and it's quite tough to decentralize people in this space. So like all this, I'm still very skeptical about AMMs, for example. And the way we see Uniswap evolves, it kind of like moves more and more towards the central order book in the end. And as all those liquidity providers will get back to us effectively. And we were not active on Uniswap V2 as a liquidity provider because it was not capital efficient model, and it was also super expensive guess wise, but we totally see ourselves as a market maker on let's say Arbitrum on Uniswap V3.
That's super interesting. So who do you think of your competition as?
It's really interesting in crypto because, well, I sense the role of market maker in crypto is also very different because, well, if you look at us, if you look at Jump or Lamida, yes, sure, we do market making, but we also do venture investments. We do launch projects, like if you look, Kronos and Wu. They have their own platform. Alameda has FTX. Jump will probably also come up with a few projects of their own. We do venture investments. So there are so many things market makers are doing in the space that the competition is like, for example, a lot of market makers we are competing with, we are still partnering with them on the venture investment side. So there is a lot of cooperation. A lot of like exchanges that we are trading on, like Coinbase, like if tomorrow we launch our own DeFi exchange and power it up as market maker, we'll be competing with them at the same time. So this competition cooperation is very, like it's very blurred lines in crypto, which is really interesting actually. And it's all not only for market makers, it's pretty much for every business. But if you look at purely market making side, I would say, yeah, it would be, well, Jump would be the top competitor for us because we're competing with them pretty much everywhere.
When you think about building a business in the crypto space and being an entrepreneur, what would your advice to other entrepreneurs be? There's a lot of people getting involved building startups now. Like, what would your top advice be to folks who want to build a business in the crypto space?
Yeah, I would say startups, like don't do anything overly general, like don't create a market maker that will trade Bitcoin perpetuals. But yeah, if you create a market maker that will focus on NFTs, for instance, or like trading, on Avalanche, that can work. And like any project, you should just focus on something which is not explored yet. And there are so many places in crypto which are not explored and not touched by most market participants that like it just presents a huge opportunity pretty much everywhere. So yeah, if you take any chains that didn't shoot up yet, but even Solana, like it's still, there's still a lot of stuff you can build on Solana, for example, like Avalanche.
So what I'm hearing you say is focus.
Yeah, focus. Just focus on one thing and do it well and grow from that. And also don't copy, just don't become, don't build a sushi swap on Avalanche, like build something new, ideally.
Build something new and focused.
Yeah.
And how would you think about raising capital? Like, you guys have raised 3 rounds now, equity, a lot of debt. How would you think about raising capital in the crypto space?
I would say current environment is very friendly for people who raise capital. Like it's relatively easy to raise capital. So I would say focus on, like, don't dilute yourselves too much. Focus, just raise a million or two and just focus on grinding the first version of product. And you can always do like a strategic round later on at much higher valuation. Like it doesn't.
What was it like raising in 2019?
2019 was super hard because it was still crypto winter. It was like we were small, the markets were small, everything was small. It was a uphill battle. And because it actually was like, it was an institutional seed, but we actually raised the first round back in 2018 and it was even worse. And we could only do it with a handful of angels, and I would be forever grateful to them for participating. And well, they must be super happy now, but it was super tough. And it was nothing compared to what it is now.
So 2018 was hard. 2019 was hard. 2020 was easier.
2020 was easier, yeah. Because it's, well, and we did basically pretty much two rounds in 2021 and mid-year and one end of the year, and became progressively much easier. But partially because we were making money, so that didn't definitely help, partially because the market was hitting up.
So 2018 was angels, 2019 was around the WeLead, and then 2020 was Lightspeed.
Yeah, so first the Series A was Lightspeed in May 2020, and then there was a Series B with Lightspeed, Pantera, you guys, and a bunch of other folks.
When you guys raised the seed round, the 2019 round, what was it that eventually got you over the line? Because I think raising rounds, and I've raised them in crypto and in crypto fund, and it is really hard, right? And it's funny, it's like the ones that you raise at the bottom that are really difficult. And I think for founders, when they're coming into a space, they've got to be ready to raise when the market's not good. What advice would you give to people when they've got to raise when the market's bad?
I would say you need, especially when the markets are bad, you still need to raise enough money to survive for a year or two. So you just need to, well, eat it up pretty much. And because I remember I was like the first, it's interesting, like, because I think it's the first time we get back to that actually from 2 years back. But like the first round with angels was easy. The round with you guys was, like, it was still crypto winter. I was feeling like really bad about the valuation at the end of it, simply because it was, I thought, okay, we should get much higher than the angel round because we did so much progress. But I can totally see how it made sense back then, valuation wise. And I would say, like, don't focus much more on, well, surviving and thriving later on than on like giving away too much capital, because yeah, it's just much more important. And
in the end, you probably don't regret that round.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was such a different business back then too. Like, it's, you know, it's grown a lot in that period. And yeah, it's been, you know, quite a privilege to watch. I don't want to keep you here all day, your thoughts on the crypto market. If you had sort of one idea that you feel like folks on the podcast should look into, learn about, maybe you're spending time learning about it, what would that be?
I would say not necessarily an idea, but like, I know a lot of people hear about DeFi in general, and I would, just from a personal experience, just dedicate a weekend or two to dig into different blockchains, just play around, because it's an amazing experience just to try out new things. Like, I dedicated one weekend to Solana for example, like a few weeks back, and it's just like really interesting to understand how things work. And one thing to understand, like, to tell, I don't know, my DeFi developers to integrate with this stuff, it's like a really different thing to try it as a user and to realize how stuff works, and because it might also give you an idea of what's missing.
I think a great idea for a YouTube show would be to get like two or three crypto founders together for an afternoon in the weekend, and everyone try to use
each other's products.
Well, or a new blockchain.
Oh, a new blockchain.
Like, all get together and try to use Avalanche for a weekend. Because it is hard, right? Like, the last one that I tried to use was Avalanche. I don't know if you've done that yet.
Not yet.
But you know, there's so much cool stuff happening over there, but getting set up on it and getting assets bridged over to it is it's a real adventure.
Yeah, and it's scary as well. It's scary.
It's terrifying. Yeah. But thank you so much for joining us and taking the time to record today, and also for building a really important business in this space.
No, thanks a lot for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.